Okay, colleagues, everyone, welcome to the week. It is Monday, March 20th, 2017. We're in the committee on the Senate Committee on the Environment and Natural Resources.
Really great.
And we are going to spend most of today's hearing on hearing Senate Bill 847. But before we do that, we have some work sessions to get through. And so I'd like to do that. These are all very straightforward things.
Did you not tell?
Beginning with potential committee measures. So I'm going to open a work session on the possible introduction of committee measures. And Vice Chair Olson.
Oh, this is going to be scary. What is it?
Just do it, and I'll tell you.
Trust him.
Just do it first, and we'll read it later.
You've already agreed to this.
I've heard that before. Chair Devereaux, I move the following legislative concept be introduced as a committee bill, LC-4173, dated 3/16/17.
Okay, the vice chair has moved the following legislative concept be introduced as a committee bill. It's LC-4173, dated March 16th, 2017. And Beth, you want to tell us overall what
sure.
It does?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, the LC would clarify that excavation or movement of materials at a landfill are not subject to the mining permitting requirements.
Right.
That's been a question.
Are we saying that they can do their work at the landfill, moving items from one place to another without having a permit?
Without a mining permit.
Oh, excellent. Right.
And the question is, what happens if they strike gold?
It's ours.
That's another question.
General Fund will be happy for that.
Right. This is a bill that the chair and the vice chair concurred to have drafted. So it's just for those of you who are new to this process, just want to clarify that the introduction of committee bills are not any indication of our feelings about this bill. It does not guarantee the bill will be scheduled. It doesn't really guarantee anything. All it does is it allows the bill to commence its journey on the legislative path. I will say this is one that I hope we can address. But is there any discussion? Okay, is there any objection to our introducing this as a committee bill? Seeing none, so ordered.
What's the relating clause on that?
good question. It is relating to surface mining.
Surface mining.
Whoops.
Okay. Got it.
All right. There's some there's some gold in them, Nar Hills. okay. So I'm going to close the work session on introduction of committee measures, and I'm going to open a work session on Senate Bill 677, which has to do with the cider businesses. We heard this last week. There was an amendment that was needed. Beth, you want to tell us what the amendment does?
Mm-hmm. Mr. Chair, members, it was the Dash 2 amendment that I believe you heard about at the hearing on the 2nd of March. It would replace the term brew. This bill was modeled on the winery statute, so it would replace the term brew with make and definitions, and also remove a requirement that an applicant for a permit to establish a cider business submit proof to a local government that the applicant meets production and acreage requirements prior to permit issuance. Finally, it modifies language clarifying the basis for a local government decision on requiring setbacks and direct road access.
Okay. Vice Chair Olson.
Chair Devereaux, I move to adopt the Dash 2 amendment stated 3/7/17.
Okay. Vice Chair Olson has moved to adopt the Dash 2 amendment stated March 7th, 2017. Colleagues, you heard what the amendments do. Is there any discussion of the amendments? Is there any objection to our adopting the amendments? Okay. Seeing none, amendments are adopted.
Chair, Chair Denver, I move Senate Bill 677 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Olson has moved Senate Bill 677 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Just to remind you, this would create a way for cideries to attain a status comparable to that of wineries here in Oregon.
I like cider.
Well,
yes, Senator Oakland.
They'll take a while. It took a while for the wine industry to get the same place. But it gives them statutorily the same, but they're still going to have to do a lot of work.
Okay, that is a. I stand technically corrected. Okay, any other discussion? Okay, is there any objection to this measure? Seeing none, the measure passes. Senator Olson, would you like to carry this?
Please.
Okay, Senator Olson will carry. I'm going to close the work session on Senate Bill 677 and open a work session on House Bill 2254. And colleagues, this is the first of the three amendments that we heard last Wednesday that came over from the House. Yes.
Good.
Vice Chair Olson.
Chair Deborah, I move House Bill 2254 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Okay, Vice Chair Olson has moved House Bill 2254 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Beth, you want to just remind us what this
sure.
does?
Mr. Chair, members, the bill would exempt commodities that are shipped directly for export from the requirements to label each individual package before shipping.
Okay. Any discussion of this? Is there any objection to this measure? Okay, seeing none, the motion passes. Who is interested in export of commodities? Who'd like to carry this?
I'll carry.
Either way.
Okay. All right.
Just three to five.
Senator Olson will carry.
Okay.
And with that, I've closed our work session on House Bill 2254, and I'll open a work session on House Bill 2255.
Chair Dumbro, I move House Bill 2255 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Okay, Vice Chair Olson has moved House Bill 2255 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Beth, what is this one?
This bill, Mr. Chair, would clarify the Department of Ag's authority to adopt rules on milk standards.
Okay, any discussion of the measure? Is there any objection to the measure? Seeing none, motion passes. All right, Senator Roblin, you can have this one.
We do have some dairy in my district.
Yes, so I've heard. Okay, so with that, I'll close the work session on House Bill 2255, and I will open our last work session. That's on House Bill 2327.
Oops. Chair Dembro, I move House Bill 2327A to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Okay, Vice Chair Olson has moved House Bill 2327A to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Beth?
Mr. Chair, members, this is the bill that made a number of changes to the OWEB statutes, which if you need me to go over any of them, I will, but last week.
Okay, we heard this last week. Collectively, they're known as the Oregon Plan for the Oregon Watershed Enhancement Board. Any discussion? Seeing none, any objection to the measure? Okay. Seeing none, the motion passes. Senator Bertrager, you want to carry this one?
Do you know when it will be? Because I still got next week.
Okay, I'll carry it myself.
Okay. I'll be good to go after April 1st.
It sounds like a joke to me.
It is.
Okay, with that, I'm going to close the work session on House Bill 2327.
I didn't want
to. And I will now open our public hearing on Senate Bill 847. While Senator Roblin goes down, Beth, can you tell us what this bill will do?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 847 would establish state policy to identify trust lands under the jurisdiction of the State Land Board that due to management or regulatory impediments have limited performance potential as common school fund assets and would transfer those identified lands to a state or federal agency or tribe better positioned than the board to manage those lands. And then it also sets up a process by which this type of transfer would be proposed and approved.
Okay, thank you, Beth. Mm-hmm. Senator Roper.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee. For the record, Arnie Roblin, state senator from District 5, Coos Bay to Tillamook Bay and over to Sheridan and Falls City in the Valley. In 2015, a work group was scheduled for a House bill. At that time, Representative Reed had brought it forward about the trust land transfer. I was working on a bill at the same time. Similar expectations. Part of what I had come to understand was the fact that in Washington, the state lands in Washington, back in, I think it was 1987, they passed a bill that did a trust lands transfer in Washington. So as they found parts of the property that were in the school fund in Washington that had other values that were greater than making money for the what we have as the common school fund, they found ways to take money out of that, put it into a fund, buy other resource land. So at this time, they have about the same number of acres that they had at the time they were they came into being statehood in their state lands for the common school fund. We had millions of acres at statehood, and in the early 1900s, there was a big scandal that took place in Oregon in which a lot of our state lands were sold off to family and friends and other people, and we lost a lot of what we had as a state fund for our schools because the selling. A number of those politicians and others went to jail over that, but the land was gone. And as we were having the conversation 2 years ago about the Elliott, this bill was an idea to have a conversation like they were having in Washington where you take parts of the forest that has significant values, whether it was for recreation or whether it was for conservation, whatever the purpose was, they would buy it from the state and then transfer it to another state agency like parks or whatever, appropriate to manage it, and then go and buy some more resource land so they could continue to have forests that were coming in and supporting the school fund. And I thought that even though Oregon is structurally set up a little different than Washington, there was a place for this, and so did at that time Representative Reed. So we had a number of meetings, and at the very end of the session, we could not really come to an agreement. And there were, we had forestry, everybody involved in the conversation. So basically what we tried to do is take the Dash 3 amendments that we'd worked towards to put it into a bill to bring back, and I had made an agreement actually with one of the groups that I would wait till after the land board made their decision about the Elliott, because to me, this is a bigger conversation. And this does not have an emergency clause, so it really wouldn't go into effect until after January of next year. But the issue was, we have about, of those millions of acres that we started out with, we now have about 618,000 acres, 82 or 630,000 acres. The majority of those acreage is held outside of the Elliott. So I guess the actual numbers, we have 658,500 acres of state school lands that are Oregon or state lands that are trust lands. Of that, 82,500 acres are the Elliott State Forest. So there's another 576,000 acres out there that are owned by the school children, in my opinion, or the trust lands in Oregon. And they need to be managed. And hopefully, if it's not an OLIS, we'll get you a copy. There's a new copy of, and I think I have enough for the committee. I'll come to you later. Of a map of Oregon that shows all these little dots all over it, where there are rangeland, forest land, a whole mix of lands that are managed by that. From my perspective, it's unmanageable. You've got too many places over too much acreage to have an agency like the state lands actually manage it, so they're going to have to bid that out to people or do things if they're going to do any kind of management. And therefore, it's really difficult to make any money off of those different parcels. So the goal was to say, I would like to have at least one more tool in the toolbox of state lands and how to get that put together in different ways to manage it, to find resources and buy more resource land. And The reason that I talked about it even before, when the Elliott was in the position, was that we have a lot of hunters and fishermen and other people who like to use state lands, and I hate losing state land. I feel really sad about, personally, the Elliott State Forest. The land board has to make their decision, and this bill will have nothing to do with them making decisions on any of this land if they want to sell it to private and do other things. That's still the tools that they have available to them. But we saw the money going to the state school fund diminish and diminish and diminish, and the actual money we had to spend to maintain roads. This is not an easy forest to manage. The roads we build, if you don't maintain them, they're going to wash out. You're not going to have roads, so if you're going to get there, it is expensive if you're not getting money off of it that you harvest. We've had big conversations in our area about having people working in the forest, because that brings money to our community. It brings tax money to the state. It has multiple values, even in the financial part of the Elliott Forest. $220 million put into the state school fund. The interest, even though it's as low as it is now, as interest goes up, they'll make more money than we've been making on the forest. So I think the state land board is still in a difficult position to make a decision about how they're going to manage that. But with all these other lands, there's no doubt that if they were put together and put together in different ways, trade with private properties or whatever, you could manage it better. You could probably start building some more value in the state lands for our common school fund. That's the genesis of this bill. And so what we're asking is the opportunity to give one more tool to the state land board and how to manage an asset that we have told them in our constitution they have to manage for the value of putting money in the state school fund. And that's the problem we've had over time. And they're making a decision right now based on that deal with respect to what to do the Elliott. I've told people I didn't know what kind of proposal was going to be made on the Elliott. I am pleased that the people who did it took it very seriously and put in tribal representation. They put in the group that helped us get the Gilcrest Forest, their input into the whole, a local company that I trust as a timber industry put the bid in. 50% of the Elliott, because of all the requirements, will always be accessible, which 50% we don't know right now. This bill will hopefully give us the opportunity to build another forest of similar place someplace with all of the land that's in little pockets all around our state. I don't know that they'll do that. It's just an opportunity to give them the tools necessary to do that. They've got to still make a decision. That's their choice, and it's the reason we didn't bring it back, or I didn't bring it back in the short session last year, was that the state land board was going around and having conversations with communities all over to talk about this. And I thought they did an exceptional job, had a lot of public input. I tell people in my district, I think it's close to 100% of the people would love to keep the Elliott Forest in public ownership. The problem is 50% of those want it to get cut down, and the other 50% want it to be a park. And so there's no real agreement about how to go about doing that. I wish we could find that place where we could have timber being produced for our local mills and people using it for recreation activities. There is no doubt in my mind that when you look at the size of the Elliott, that it couldn't be managed for all those purposes. But we have been unable to, from lawsuit to the cost that we go through to do a sale. You don't get any money after you're done anyway. So, I mean, it doesn't help us. And that's my concern. And it's the concern if you look at all these lands that are all over our state, some of them bigger than the Elliott. I want there to be a public access to those for the long term for hunters and fishermen and other places. And I want to figure out how to maximize the value for the state school fund at the same time. And this is one of those tools that allows us to do that. So I hope you'll look at it seriously. I think there are probably some other people that want to talk about it. And I'm always open to work with people to make it better. And I thank people in this committee for allowing me to make our septic system better by passing the bill that we did today on the floor. So it's always a work in process. That's why we have us come back to meet every year now, is to figure out how to do it best. And I will tell you that the effort, the time, the people who spent it trying to figure out solutions over the last couple of years made it even more imperative for me to bring this bill back for us to have one more tool, and I'll be glad to answer any questions you might have.
Okay. Thank you, Senator. I'll start off. So the decision not to put an emergency clause on the bill essentially probably likely keeps it from being relevant to the Elliott. If a path were found where it could be a useful tool for dealing with the Elliott, would you be opposed to the emergency clause?
I would really like to have a conversation about that before it was done. I'm not going to be the one that puts that. I told people from the very beginning that from my perspective, the state land board had a decision to make. It was their decision. If they had chosen not to go forward, which they didn't do at the time, it probably would have been available for this bill to work with in January of next year. I guess what I would hear is what the if the general body felt that that was an important thing to do, then it's worth doing it. But I had made a semi-commitment to myself because of the conversations we've had about our emergency clauses that I would try to have bills that didn't have emergency clauses.
Unless they were needed.
Unless they were needed.
Thank you, Senator. Vice Chair Olson.
Thank you very much. Live long and prosper.
Yes, thank you.
I saw your badge.
Yes, I did. I
do have one question. When you say you want to transfer to another state agency or federal agency, how could the federal agency benefit us? Because they don't
I just
to
think
be
that every once in a while
things.
The federal agency may change their policy on how we use some of this land, and therefore conglomerating us and giving us some of theirs to make ours whole, as opposed to having a checkerboard that we have all over the place in the southern Oregon, could be of value. And okay. Therefore, having equal amounts of land traded to put together a plan could be a really good opportunity to work with the federal government.
And follow up?
Yes.
Yeah, if you don't mind, and I just want to clarify this for myself. If we transfer some lands that are some state agency can do more with them, how do we get that money into the school fund?
Yeah, so in Washington, they have to have a proposal, and we have to get the value that's equal to an appraised value of that property that we could go into the school fund. So just like they're doing with the Elliott right now, they've got an appraisal of it. This is what it's worth. They get that amount of money. They put it in the school fund, so the kids are held harmless with regard to the sale, other than the long-term values of having the forest. In this case, it would be the same way. They could sell it to a private conglomerate. They've already got that power. They could do that with some of this other land. And I think they have done some with individual parcels over in the Bend area where they have the city encroaching into some other areas. And so they didn't really want to own land that was in the urban growth boundary when they could get some other stuff. So there's ways of doing that. But there needs to be a transfer of resources and or so it could be that you've got state forests has a place that has greater value, but this one has a unique value for fish and wildlife, so that we make a kind of an internal transfer of land itself. But it could also be that there's values that we want to pay for and we're willing to come up with some money to pay for it. Washington has an easier time with that because they have a special fund that they have that they've developed over time for buying other new property and keeping the whole corpus of their land open. We don't have that same opportunity. But I would say if Fish and Wildlife said there's a special thing there and we want to keep that, then they would need to come to the legislature and say, find the money so we can transfer this over. Or they go to the forestry department and say, forestry, we'd like you to trade this piece of land to get this piece of land. So in that transfer, it can mean actual cash that goes into the school fund, or it could mean properties of equal values. I believe that's how it would work.
Yeah, follow up. You just piqued my interest on something you said, that if ODFW sees it, they need to come to us to find. We already own it.
That's true.
So
no, we don't. We don't own this land.
No.
This is trust land.
Who owns it?
I would say the Kids of Oregon own it because that's how it was given to us. So there may be some other trust responsibilities in there, but State Land Board, who is not part of the legislature and is not. It's kind of the executive branch, but it's got a special place in our Constitution.
Okay.
That was formed when we were formed. And this land had a special place with respect to the federal government when they granted statehood to give us some land.
Okay, thank you, Senator.
Yep.
Great. So we have a representative of the Washington State Department of Natural Resources on the phone. And we're going to hear from him to hear how the program works up in Washington. Senator Roblin alluded to it. and now we can get the details and get some questions answered there. So, Mr. Millian, thank you for your patience.
And I hope, and this is Senator Roblin, I hope I didn't say anything different than what you're doing. So.
Yes, and feel free, if you have to correct Senator Roblin, he's he'll be more than open to that.
That's right.
Exactly. The good news is I could only hear half of that, what Senator Roblin was saying, so it all sounded fine to me. Okay. So I'll introduce myself real fast. My name is Brock Miller. I'm our division manager at DNR for our recreation, conservation, and real estate transactions division. It's a new position to me, so I think I know at least some of the details, but if you have any questions that I can't answer, I'll happily get back to you all with those answers. So I'll talk a little bit. I think kind of the history of our program was covered, so I'll ignore that part unless there's questions about it. Instead, what I'll do is I'll talk about how it's worked for us. I think just in general, our program allows for the recipient of land to be any state or local government. So that includes our counties, you know, our state park system. It's worked pretty well. We worked through about 9 different transactions this biennium. We're finishing up the last couple right now, and those have included a pretty good mix of state and local governments. We have 2 left. One is actually going to be a project that goes to the Department of Natural Resources Conservation Program. The other one is going to be a chunk of land that goes to Kitsap County. We, of course, do these for many different reasons, but the underlying reason is that the land has become unproductive. In some instances, that's because it's become surrounded by a city, and the social and political challenges to harvest have become, as such that it doesn't make it viable. In some instances, it's been that the conservation value is such that we, simply wouldn't harvest or couldn't, for legal reasons, harvest. It has helped to make sure that the DNR does maintain our acreage and does maintain a pretty viable beneficiary program and benefits. I couldn't tell you the volume over the years, but I know that depending on the biennium, we've been anywhere from this biennium that we're working right now is a relatively small one, and it's around $10 million. We've been in the $100 million range when the program started out, and there were quite a few trust assets that were not viable for us to manage anymore and made more sense for someone else to manage. One of the things I wanted to make sure, because I think the question was asked as far as how we make sure that the trust is made whole, the beneficiaries are made whole, because we do see, this is common school land, so it's the school children of Washington is, when that money is appropriated, the timber value goes to the beneficiary, and the land value goes to the department to buy replacement land. As you all probably might already know, when you go to buy replacement for land right now, it's seldom you're able to find replacement land with timber still standing on it, or with infrastructure in place that makes it immediately economically valuable for more than just the land value. So for that reason, the timber value has always gone to the beneficiaries to keep that pot of money whole. There has been kind of an underlying theme that the goal has been to want to balance so that 80% of those funds go to the beneficiaries and only about 20% go to the department for replacement lands. This biennium, and I think in the future one, there's been a bit of a push against that. There's kind of been push on both sides, predominantly because some of our lands now, a lot of those lands that had the 80% timber value on them are gone now, but we still have some unproductive lands that we can't do anything with, some of which have zero timber value. So that's something that DNR and our state legislature is wrestling with right now. But in general, it's been a good program. It's helped to bring you know, it's helped to keep some of the last standing forest land in areas that are heavily developed. It's helped to, you know, create opportunities for conservation with connectivity between maybe some federal lands or whatever it might be. But it's done some good things, and local folks have been able to use it to create parks and do things that are really valuable to those individual communities, while we've also been able to keep our beneficiaries whole in the process. Yeah, I think that's about what I have, and I'm happy to take any questions.
Brock, can you tell us, you know, in terms of some examples of transfers that have happened, who have been the, you know, the recipients of the transfers? Local governments, county governments, state agencies, et cetera?
Yep. So the two that we're working on right now, we have the Morningstar Natural Resource Conservation Area, which is up about 45 minutes north of Seattle, maybe an hour north of Seattle. That will be the recipient of quite a few acres. I can't remember the exact volume, but I think it's around $5 or $6 million that is going to be purchasing out of trust and into that conservation area. We have in Kitsap County, which is just across the water from Seattle, we have a county government that is going to be receiving some land, and I can't remember. I feel like that's a smaller one. I think it's in the less than 100 acre range, but I have to go back and double check that.
I have a question, Brock. So, yeah. And does the county kick in any resources in that kind of arrangement, or do they just take over management and that's their share?
Yep, they take over management and that's their share. Yeah, in these instances, we a small portion, 1.9% of the funds that are allocated to the Trust Land Transfer Program can be used for administrative costs here at DNR. So one of my staff basically is paid out of that funds, because when you're talking about that many transactions, it takes, you know, a good portion of the biennium. And that is how the administrative costs are covered there. There's no expectation for that local government. We also have, I believe we have at least one in which our Department of Fish and Wildlife is the recipient. So it is really spread around between different government agencies. The one that I'm trying to recall from the Fish and Wildlife Agency, it was a place where there's a lot of elk calving going on, and it wasn't that productive of ground for the trust as it was, but the conservation value for wildlife was high, and it made sense for us to move out of it. We usually have around half the projects that are going to DNR natural areas, oftentimes because what has happened is there was already pressure on land in that geographic vicinity, and for conservation value, for whatever it may be, and a portion of it was turned into a natural area, and that in many instances we were able to do some more harvest, but that kind of growing conservation value, whatever it might be, has continued to change it. So instead of, you know, having a transfer to a county government or whatever it might be, we're already managing land for conservation value in that area, and so we keep it. And one of the benefits to the department to having that land is that some of our conservation lands can be used as conservation lands under our habitat conservation plan to offset, you know, where we can harvest in other places. So that's one of the reasons for us to have some of that land, also because we're managing in that area already, and it's, you know, not creating, as you all may know, people don't like it when we're having to cross jurisdictions constantly. So it creates some continuity.
Gotcha. Okay, Senator Roblin has a question, Brian.
So in the Kitsap situation, where does the value that the land had, the land value, where does that money come from so you can get other resource land for it?
Yeah, so In that instance, I think it's a $1.9 million project. I think it's not at 80%, a little bit less than that. So maybe say 70% of that is in the land value. We would have, if the total purchase price was $1.9 million, we would get $1.9 million, and we would basically immediately turn whatever the timber value was over to the trust. So in this instance, if we're going to end up with, I want to say around $600,000 of land value, we then that comes off of that 1.9, and we can go buy replacement land because it's common school anywhere in the city.
So
it can be ag land or forest land in the near area.
So
but it comes off. We get our projects are the total project, so land and timber together, and we do the dividing up based on the appraisal.
And so what I'm trying to get at, because it's different for you than it is for us, Kitsap doesn't have to pay anything, and they get it. Where does the $1.9 million come from?
Oh, it comes, I'm sorry, I misunderstood the question.
Yep.
It comes from a direct appropriation from the legislator, and that money is bonded money.
And Brock, just following up on that, is this something that is bonded on a project-specific basis, or is there a pot of money that's sitting out there that is maintained through an ongoing bond?
In my familiarity with the program, and this may have been different, 20, 25 years ago, but it's on a project-specific basis. So a list of projects, just like with any budget request we have of the legislator, we submit a request for funding for the TLT program, Trust Land Transfer Program, and we submit specific projects. And historically, from my knowledge of it, but I believe historically, the legislator has then cut that project list down, right, not funded the entire thing, and picked specific projects for us. So we actually, I believe, requested probably more in the $30 million range last biennium. It was cut down to about $9.6 million, and there were 8 or 9 projects on that list that were specifically dedicated that we were to do with that funding.
And do you know what kind of bonds they are? Are they general obligation bonds, or are they revenue bonds? Do you have a sense of that?
I'm not positive,
yeah.
But I think they're general obligation bonds.
Okay, thank you. Any other questions, colleagues? Okay, Brock, thank you very much. This is very helpful,
yeah,
this background.
Absolutely. Yep.
Yeah.
Good luck.
Okay, thank you. Bye-bye. Okay, great. So we have some people to bring up, and I'm just going to bring you up in the order in which you signed up. So the first panel will be Tom Wolfe, Michael Salvaggio, and Rhett Lawrence, please. And while they're coming up, is there anyone else who would like to speak on this who hasn't signed up? Everyone who's signed up is in support of this bill, and I can't believe there are no naysayers out there, but anyway, let's hear your support. Tom?
Chair Dambrough, committee members, for the record, my name is Tom Wolfe, representing Trout Unlimited. And I want to talk, my group is a conservation group. We're a conservation group made up of hunters and anglers. And recently, back in the first full weekend in February, they had what's referred to as the Portland Sportsman Show. It takes place at the Expo Center every year, and it brings in over 100,000 sportsmen from Portland and Vancouver area. And you may not realize this, but hunters and anglers are much more concerned about losing access to public lands than hikers and others. It's a great fear. And, when Weyerhaeuser started charging money for access to their land recently, there was a great outrage from the hunting and fishing community because they were losing access to valuable lands. So I decided since I, you know, the session had just started and things were just getting going, and I figured, I can just have free time during the weekend because, you know, I don't plan on ever actually doing fun things on weekends till the session ends anyway, that I would go and just talk to people at the Sportsman Show. So I went around, totally unscientific data, and talked to everybody I could about the concept of, at that time, it wasn't a bill out, but we had a pretty good concept of where the trust land transfer bill was going. Is what do you feel about the idea that you could protect over 500,000 acres in Oregon and put them in the hands of sportsmen by allowing them to be managed by a state land agency? And the responsibility, the response was almost 100% yes. I mean, sportsmen really want to see land, public land, protected so that they can use them. And you see it in their magazines, you read it in books, it's out there. And so Trout Unlimited, as a group of hunters and fishers, adamantly and vigorously support SB 847. It's the right concept. It's as Senator Roblin, who we thank profusely for all his work on this, it's a tool. It's a tool that, you know, that we can use for the remaining over 500,000 acres of common school fund land out there to protect them, so that hunters and anglers like me, and I've been hunting and fishing since I was 5 years old, which means that that's almost 60 years, but let's not do the math. So it's a great tool for groups like ours, and I know that you got a letter from Oregon Hunters Association supporting this bill too. So please, as you take this, I hope that you consider that this bill isn't only for, you know, quote unquote, the environmental groups, but it's for all of us that enjoy the outdoors, the hunters and anglers. Hunting, angling, and wildlife viewing brings $3 billion into the economy of Oregon every year. And the outdoor industry brings $12.8 billion into the Oregon economy every year. So protecting this land, keeping it, it's allowing hunters and fishers and others to access it will not only help those people pursue the sports they love so much, but help Oregon's economy. We support and urge you to pass out a committee, SB 847. Thank you.
Thank you, Tom. Michael.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Michael Salvaggio with the Portland Audubon Society. We are also supporting this measure. I like to say to people that upon becoming a state, Oregon received a gift basket of these lands from the federal government with strings attached. And as you've heard earlier, those strings are that they need to be used to maximize long-term revenue for the benefit of Oregon schools. As Senator Roblin said, these lands are not owned by the state specifically. They're owned by Oregon school children. And therefore, it's important for us that when we talk about these lands, we talk about transfers, we keep in mind the principle that those school children and the trust of the Common School Fund needs to be made whole. That provides some ongoing tension between the land board's responsibilities as they manage these lands, between their Admission Act responsibilities to maximize long-term revenue versus their constitutional responsibility of obtaining generally the greatest benefit for the people of this state. And although they may sound similar, I just want to point out on the record, and this is coming from a what's generally considered to be the ruling bit of advice on the land board's management, which is called the Crookham Opinion from 1992 on management, where they refer back to the original intent of the Constitution's responsibility on the state land board, saying the proposed amendment will remove a strict cash income objective permitting land uses varying with location, type of land, needs of the citizens of the state. And now that doesn't mean that we don't have to consider a cash objective, because we still have the Admission Act by the feds. But like I'm saying, that tension often creates some problems, and we're seeing some of that political tension and financial tension on the Elliott State Forest right now. This measure would be a fantastic tool in our toolbox to help deal with that. It allows for conveyance to other public ownership The fund that's created, in addition to facilitating that conveyance, allows for leveraging state and public dollars with private dollars as well. And so while there is some value in maintaining a diversified portfolio, this bill provides the State Land Board with the flexibility to manage these lands, to address their financial needs without exposing Oregon Public Lands to private sales. It's adding a option that they technically have right now but is not very well facilitated in state statutes. I think that there's a broad interest in maintaining public ownership of these lands. You've heard some of it already. You're going to hear some more of it, I'm guessing. Generally, selling them to private ownership would eliminate the requirement of processing the timber in-state that's in the Constitution. We would, as my colleague said, lose public access with regard to recreation and hunting purposes, but also we're moving the management of some of these pristine lands outside of the public's watchful eye, and that's a concern that we have as well. So this measure is applicable to a large swath of trust lands around the state, not just forest land, not just range land, but also certain commercial properties and urban properties that happen to be within our trust as well. Clearly, there is a discussion surrounding the Elliott State Forest, but I just want to be very clear for the record. This bill is larger than the Elliott State Forest. If this tool had been in place for the last several decades, it's quite possible that we may have avoided the tension that we're seeing this session around that. And so we just want to express our clear and unambiguous support for this bill and urge you to pass it out.
Thank you, Mike. Brett.
Sorry.
Thank you, Chair Dembrough, members of the committee. My name is Rhett Lawrence. I'm the conservation director for the Oregon Chapter of the Sierra Club. Also here to express our support for Senate Bill 847 and thank Senator Roblin for bringing it back this session. I have submitted written testimony, and I think you've heard a good summary of what the bill would do from Senator Roblin and from some of my colleagues here. But I do think, you know, this bill gives us a good opportunity to stop making the false choices between protecting our environment and funding education. You know, as we've heard, there is a great interest shared by my members all around the state, keeping public lands public. I think this gives us a great mechanism to continue to keep public lands in public ownership. I won't rehash the rest of what's been said today, you know, other than to say, obviously, this does have some pertinence to the Elliott State Forest. An issue that we've been working on for a number of years. And again, you know, it's another tool in the toolbox to help us solve that problem. It is a much bigger mechanism than that. It will serve many more purposes than just that. But I do think it can help us to potentially provide a partial solution to that conundrum. And so we are very supportive of it for that reason as well. So, you know, urge your support for this bill and happy to take any questions.
Thanks, Rhett.
Thank you.
Yes, Senator Richarder.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You know, Tom, you testimony, it sounds like these lands are locked up and they're not accessible to the public, which is not true that public can go on any of these lands. But your testimony was like they're locked up, and if we sell them or transfer them, they're not locked up. So I just wanted to remind you, currently they're not locked up and the public has full access to them. And the other thing, Mr. Chair, I don't know where I'm at on the bill, but I would have, you know, I know many of these lands, and many of these lands are very, very productive, and adding money to this common school fund, either through timber harvests or grazing fees or any of that stuff. And I would certainly like to see at least a decade of record of how much money this has brought into the school fund over the last 10 years before I could ever consider voting for something like this. Thank you.
Yeah, I think we can get that information. It seems to always be part of the Ways and Means process. So, Tom, you want to answer the first one?
Chair Dembrough, Senator Barsugar, you're absolutely right. They're not locked up, but we do sometimes worry. I mean, when you think of what is could happen to the Elliott, that it will go to the hands of private landowners that under the agreement they're only required to give access to 50%. And frankly, the discussion that we've had with the hunting and fishing groups is a lot of times when they start talking about easements and areas that will be protected, the areas that will be protected would be, as one of my colleagues from TU, Dean Finnery, said, is that the jumbled up areas that provide no value for hunting will be the areas protected. So we worry that the areas that will be logged, the areas that provide good feral habitat, that those will be the areas lost if somehow this land is lost, is sold, and not allowed, the access is restricted. Because, frankly, and I'm speaking just for the hunters here, not only deer and elk hunters, but grouse and mountain quail hunters like myself, who feral habitat is very important. So we do worry that if some of this land is sold to private, if it is lost, that we hunters will lose access to the land that we most value to hunt on. So,
response, Mr. Chair?
Yes, please.
Tom, I couldn't disagree. I'm a hunter and fisherman too, but I have to remind you, and I'm not even lukewarm to the sale of the Elliott. Okay. But at the other side of the coin is the environmental community created this, okay? If we would have just all got together and had a roundtable discussion on how to manage the Elliott, because if you're a hunter, you also know that clear cuts are also good for it too. So if we would have all sat around the table and came to a consensus of how to manage the Elliott, we would not be here today. So the environmental community is probably more responsible for the sale of the Elliott than anybody else, and it really saddens me to see the direction we're going. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Yes, Michael.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, along those lines, it was mentioned earlier by Senator Roblin, I think, that he wanted to be able to see timber harvests and recreational access coexisting on the forest. And for the record, that's very much in line with our view as well. We do not oppose harvesting the Elliott Forest. And I think that so long as there is a plan that comports to the types of conservation standards that not only are written into state and federal law, but also enshrined in our Constitution, where it says that the management must be consistent with the conservation of this resource under sound techniques of land management, we're fine with that. We don't have a blanket opposition to seeing timber harvest. But I can say that I would suspect that had the previous plans been more in line with that, then we would be actively seeing that kind of coexisting priority on the Elliott today.
Vice Chair Olson.
Thank you. I still have trouble getting my head around the fact that it's not our land, but we're going to borrow to buy it to provide for the school fund. I've got to work on that to figure out how that all works. But I look at this map and I ask the question, how can you be certain that a transfer to a federal agency or state agency or a tribal agency would not put that land off limits to us? Because if they take control of it, they might want to do with it what they want, not what we would like to see done with it. So can you, anyone give me an answer to how we could guarantee that it would still be open to the public?
Michael.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, the short answer is you would have the same or better guarantees than you currently have when the land board is allowed to consider sales to private ownership. Currently, the land board is free to sell an assessed piece of land or many assessed pieces of land off to whatever owners they choose. And if that's a private owner, then we're in the same boat. What this bill does, however, is sets up a more regimented process for that, which I hope for certain would involve a discussion regarding the access rules and that type of those type of parameters going forward before the sale occurred. but there's no less protections than currently exist.
Thank you.
Great, thank you.
Okay, gentlemen, thank you very much. Okay, our next panel is Jennifer Haynes, Peggy Lynch, and Jesse Salisbury, please.
Good afternoon, gentlemen. Chair Dembrow, members of the committee. Peggy Lynch, League of Women Voters of Oregon. You see me in the building a lot. But we have members from all over this state advocating for league positions. And Jennifer Haynes is here because she has been working on the issue around the Elliott for a number of years and testified in support of the 2015 Trust Land Transfer Bill. We are continuing to support the governor's work to find a path to keep the Elliott in public hands. So if an emergency clause is needed, we may ask for that amendment as you work on this bill. But Jen will offer our complete testimony. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Peggy. Jen, welcome.
Thank you, Chair Dembrow and members of the committee. I'm Jennifer, as Peggy said, and we also have our testimony online. If you'd like to read it, I'm not going to read the whole thing.
Jennifer?
I'm sure you'll be happy to hear.
Jennifer, can I interrupt?
Oh, Jennifer Haynes, H-A-Y-N-E-S. Sorry about that. So we are in support of Senate Bill 847. And we reviewed the Senate bill, which creates a process for trust lands transfer program and creates a fund to accept monies to pay for such transfers. The bill creates a process for the State Land Board, Department of State Lands, and Legislative Assembly to coordinate transfer of certain lands, trust lands managed for the benefit of the Common School Fund that have limited performance potential as assets of the Common School Fund to certain other public bodies better positioned to protect, to manage those lands for the benefit of the public. We support SB 847 because we believe it will help the State Land Board to move forward in decoupling the Elliott State Forest from the Common School Fund and keeping the Elliott State Forest public. Our public lands are an irreplaceable resource and should be kept public for the enjoyment of future generations. Other states have used this method, as you know, when public lands are threatened in order to preserve them for future generations. League acknowledges that the Elliott disposition is a very difficult issue because of an outdated arrangement that couples the pristine forest ecosystem to school funding. Our schools and protection of our forests are both important, and one should not have to be chosen at the expense of the other. This bill allows for a solution that keeps the Elliott public and decouples it from the school fund. A trust land transfer option can protect the Elliott's remaining native forests, including the old growth forests that are disappearing from our landscape, can protect the wild salmon and imperiled wildlife, safeguards the Elliott for public recreation and educational opportunities, and can promote timber jobs by restoratively thinning the second growth tree farms. This bill can help stop the privatization of the Elliott State Forest, but to be clear, this bill is about more than just the Elliott. A trust land transfer program is a good long-term solution to protect future threatened Common School Fund lands and to keep all of them public. In conclusion, the Elliott State Forest has become an Oregon icon as something other than an investment that is meant to earn an income, if only for the endangered species that use the forest. As such, the League supports SB 847 as part of a plan to decouple the school funding from the Elliott State Forest and other lands as a public treasure for future generations. Thank you.
Thank you, Jen.
Yes. Peggy Lynch, League of Women Voters. Unfortunately, Senator Bertschiger is gone, but I wanted to note his statement that he wanted to see a decade of losses before he would be interested in selling. I think that will be an important piece of information for you to have. It's my understanding that the Elliott only lost 3 years' worth of monies, and so... That's a good marker to consider, and I appreciated his statement.
Right, yeah. And just to clarify, I don't think he was asking for 10 years of loss. He wanted to see the record for the last 10 years.
That's what I'm saying. Yeah. I think getting the record would be a really good thing for you to have.
Yes, thank you, Peggy. Jesse, welcome.
Hello. For the record, Jesse Salisbury with Backcountry Hunters and Anglers. I thank you, Senator Chair, and the committee for the opportunity to speak on behalf and before you for Backcountry Hunters and Anglers. Our organization, leaders, members, partners, and sportsmen across this great state applaud Senator Roblin's SB 847 for the reasons that much of my colleagues and Senator Roblin himself have already described to you. I would like to point out just quickly, as though it's hard not to look onto the Elliott in context of this bill, but we see the long-term benefits of this, and it gives us the opportunity, and especially the Estate and Land Board, who seems to be stuck within kind of an absolute decision whether to sell or not sell. Much of my colleagues have already brought up the word toolbox, and that's exactly this, in that we're able to explore different and alternative solutions and keep these public lands within public hands. And I believe that this bill is able to do so by satisfying multiple interests, including our common school funds, including outdoor recreationists and people who simply enjoy, and of course, not to mention our future generations of hunters, outdoor recreationists, and Oregonians. So with that, we are deeply in support of this bill, and I thank you for your time.
Thank you, Jesse. Colleagues, any questions for this panel? Okay, thank you very much. Okay, now our last panel, we have Paige Spence, Barbara Wilson, Bob, and Bob Van Dyke.
Go ahead. I like being last. All right, go ahead.
Okay. Well, I'll be very brief. For the record, Chair Dembro, committee members, Bob Van Dyke with the Wild Salmon Center. The points I was going to make have largely been made already. We're in support of this bill. I want to thank Senator Roblin over a couple biennia now for having stuck with this. I'm glad to see there's not a lot of opposition to it today, so I hope we can create this tool. As others have said, this doesn't require the land board to do anything. It just creates a process where the legislature would become a partner with them to try to resolve this tough nut that we've got that puts various social demands in tension with funding for schools, and we need a long-term solution to address that. So thank you for the opportunity to testify.
Thanks. Ms. Wilson?
Chairman Dembro, Vice Chair Olson, and members of the committee. I am Barbara Wilson. I'm a member of the League of Women Voters. I'm not a spokesperson for them by any means, but I certainly support their testimony on this issue. I won't repeat what's already been said, but I do want to take a slightly different tact. We have a situation in Washington, D.C. that's really brutal on the environment. And if you watch cable news like I do, you're well aware that the administrator of the EPA doesn't believe in climate change and doesn't really believe in much that's environmental. And we have a president who doesn't believe in climate change and is also very brutal but the Congress itself is talking about removing the Antiquities Act so that a president cannot sign for monuments. In other words, the situation is getting rather dire in protecting natural areas and wildlife habitat with this new administration. I want to point out that once the forest is cut, then what? The trees are gone, and the jobs are finished, and the money is spent, and future generations of Oregonians are left with the mess. As population increases, these very special areas of beautiful trees, salmon runs, clean streams, these areas become less and less available to us. 82,000 acres is a huge piece of property and makes a significant difference to the environment of Oregon and to the perpetuation of fish and wildlife. So as far as climate change, forests are considered the lungs of the world. They take in the pollutants and pump out the oxygen, And that's important, especially as our... Did I say something that's incorrect? I believe that's correct. I read it everywhere. I asked that the state hang on to a magnificent piece of property. Please do not allow this piece of property to go into private hands. As far as locking up the property, if it's being logged, the average citizen cannot enter the property during logging operations. We all know that. So I ask you to pass what I've heard is a toolbox measure. I do have one question. Am I allowed to ask a question?
Give it a try.
Would this satisfy the objections of Treasurer Reed?
Don't know the answer to that question. He helped at the original inception of this bill.
Okay. I went to two of the state lands public hearings, and the second one was held on February 14th. And the vote, as you know, well aware, the vote came 2-1 with the governor very eloquently expressing her support that the Elliott be held in public hands. And Treasurer Reed felt compelled to vote against her, it wasn't really a motion, her point of view because he felt compelled to comply with the Common School Fund. So I just wondered if this would satisfy him.
You'll have to make an appointment and ask him.
Thank you.
Paige.
Good afternoon, Chair Dembro and committee members. For the record, my name is Paige Spence, and I'm the director of the Oregon Conservation Network. The Oregon Conservation Network is coordinated through the Oregon League of Conservation Voters and is a coalition of nearly 40 not-for-profit organizations throughout the state who are united to advocate for pro-conservation legislation and to fight policies that threaten our state's natural legacy. The Oregon Conservation Network very much supports Senate Bill 847, and thanks Senator Roblin for introducing it. And thank you all for the opportunity to discuss our position. But I'm going to spare you the remainder of my lengthy, brilliantly crafted testimony because you've already heard from several of our member organizations. The Oregon Conservation Network includes groups such as the Wild Salmon Center, Trout Unlimited, Cascadia Wildlands, Portland Audubon, Friends of Mount Hood, and the Oregon chapter of the Sierra Club, who have all either testified in person today or have submitted written testimony. So today, this committee is asked to support legislation to create a trust land transfer program through Senate Bill 847. And the Oregon Conservation Network believes that this would help transfer Common School Fund lands out of programs where they're not being, where they're not living up to their financial potential and allow them to be open for public benefits. So for this reason, I echo all of my Oregon Conservation Network colleagues and urge you to support Senate Bill 847. Thank you.
Thank you, Paige. Questions, colleagues? Yes, Senator Bridger.
For the nice lady at the end, when you asked, am I wrong? You are not wrong. Actively growing forests do lock up carbon and produce oxygen. Non-active growing forests do not. So you are right.
They lock up carbon.
They lock up carbon, but they...
They respirate more carbon dioxide.
Yeah.
They
do the opposite when they're at the end of their lifespan.
Okay, so what did I say that was different?
Nothing. You have. There's a difference. Actively growing. So, I'll give you an example. This time of year, if you go in the forest, and you see the new leaders that are bright green, and you can see the old growth and then the new growth. Those forests are actively growing. Trees that do not show that are no longer growing. They're just there.
Some of our old growth forests don't produce. They continue to sequester lots of carbon, but they don't give as much oxygen out as the littler ones do. That's all I was.
Right. But conceivably, I will say, you know, as we're talking about the public benefit, eventually as we understand the science and the economics of carbon sequestration, there could be real value there.
Oh, there is.
Right, especially in those old growth trees.
Until they catch fire, then the
Yeah,
then
but the old ones don't catch fire that fast, right?
Well, if we clean out the forest enough so that they don't, it works. The biscuit, right. A lot of old growth burned down.
Right.
Come down and visit me. I'll show you.
But you're right. I mean, if managed correctly,
yes,
there's less likelihood that they will die, especially on the east side.
I can show you about 300,000 acres.
I know. No, but if you cleaned it all out and you didn't have the underbrush in the big old pine forests, they used to weather a lot of fire in the old days when there were just a few of them per acre.
As long as you didn't get a running crown.
That's right. I agree.
You know, in term, the bill refers to public benefits.
Right. Yes.
And I just wanted to kind of clarify what your intent was, Senator. Now I'm actually directing to you,
yeah,
or to anyone, what we think of when we think of public benefits. Are we thinking of things like, I mean, I think recreation was mentioned before, hunting, angling.
Right. Go back to 1992, and I think Mr. Salvaggio talked about it. There was a court case that talked about that, and actually I defined it. So it's different than at the original inception of the Constitution, when they basically said, here you have some money for the state land. This is, and its value is the money that it produces off of it. That was kind of what we used that forest for until probably the 1980s, and then we started having these new conversations about what was the value of the forest land and rangeland, for that matter, because of both of them. And it became a much bigger conversation. And in 92, there was a lawsuit, and the courts decided that there are other values that are we have to hold, and things, clean water, air, recreation, gathering. You know, First Nations have a real big deal about having some plants and other kinds of things that we don't use as much, but they used to use a lot. So there's a lot of different values that we have. My belief has always been that Common School Fund, I'm going back to the Constitution. I want to go to schools. I mean, I'm going to be real honest. And so if you can figure out a way to transfer lands and then still keep those lands that can be productive, that would be really great. I will tell you that when it comes to forest practices, Mr. Phillips, who was the forester for us, the state, managed the Elliott for a long time. He wanted to show all forest people that there was different ways to manage. So he put the Elliott Forest on a management regime of 150 years.
Yep.
And then we changed the definition of old growth from 150 years, which is where he set it on, so he could keep managing the forest, to 100 years. And all of a sudden he lost a third of the forest that he'd been growing over a long period of time to show people how to get the value out of it. And it made almost unmanageable the rest of the forest because he lost so much. Because he worked under the assumption that an old growth was 150 years old or older. It changed, and part of his forest was no longer manageable because it was in the old growth portion. Old growth is a term of art that basically talks about the conditions that are in the forest. So you've got a canopy that pretty much smothers out the bottom stuff so you don't get a lot of stuff growing in it. And there's a whole lot of characteristics of an old growth forest. The truth is, through modern management practices, we can get old growth characteristics in 80 to 90 years. So, I mean, the reality is those things are happening. But that doesn't change the need to have predictability, and we unpredicted the value of the forest over time. And so parts that used to be considered part of the what we could, it was a, you know, what do they call it, a plantation forest, became not a plantation forest. And in the Elliott, they also didn't use, we're only going to put back Douglas fir. There are parts that are that way, but other parts of that forest were raised for other species as well. And our forests on the Pacific Northwest, Douglas fir aren't the final chapter in an old growth forest. Oh. It's hemlock, I think.
Hemlocks, so you got cedars, all those.
Oh, cedars too. All those old growing ones that really grow old, and they will eventually drown out all the what we call the good fiber of the forest that we try to raise. So there's just so much in understanding how all the different values of a forest and how they go from a grassland to a forest. The sad part is, on the west side of Oregon, we have the greatest growing capacity for timber in the world. There's no place like us. I mean, it just drives me crazy when people think you can't rotate crops and do stuff on these forests. We have the best ground in the world. The soil's great, the water's great, it's just great conditions to have forests, and to manage them actively is a really, I think, important thing. And I get frustrated at times when we can't do what Senator Betscher said at the beginning, sit down in a room and just come to the greatest value. Because as I tell my kids and stuff, elk and deer, they live in forests, but they eat in meadows and in clear cuts and those kinds of places. If they all they had is old growth, they would be eaten on the fringes, and they begin. And what's happening is our farmers are feeding them, because the only land that they can get out of the forest to get food is where we're doing our farming. And it's not good for the state to manage their wildlife on the backs of farmers and other people. So we've got to have real conversations about this stuff, in my opinion. So that's where this bill comes from, in part. That's where the heart of the bill for me is all those different values. And they will change. I mean, 20 years from now, you're right, the carbon market might say that a sequestered tree or a timber building is a much better way to sequester carbon. And you can use some of the younger ones. And exactly what he said, when you take early growing forests up to that 80-year mark is when they produce the most oxygen. When they get to be 100, 150 years old, they're also breathing in. They're doing the same thing we are. They make carbon dioxide just like we do. It's just that at certain times in their growth period, they produce more oxygen than the carbon dioxide that they produce. So I just wish more people cared a lot and decided to study it for a lot. So that's where the heart of the bill is. And I love the fact that we have this land. And it makes me sad that we can't keep it.
I'm sure there is a lot of science going on around this, Senator. I do have one. So did anybody have anything else to add?
Chair Dembrough, committee members, I would just add back to your question about, other public benefits that would be lost. I think Senator Roblin's absolutely right. And I know that this bill is not about the Elliott State Forest, but since it's been used as an example, I'll just mention that, as others mentioned, the access issue. So, for example, the Elliott is currently public and is available to people. If it were to be sold to a private company, there's no guarantee that that access would be maintained. And so just being able to continue to use the land for the purposes that people do now, or again, Oregon's first state forest was the Elliott, and it became a state forest in 1933. So for all of the reasons you can think of that Oregonians enjoy state forests, state parks, and other recreation areas, that's kind of the principles of public access that the conservation community has had in mind as well, in addition to what Senator Roblin mentioned.
And yes.
One last thing to say. Two of our, what I believe, are our greatest forests are Tillamook Forest and Elliott Forest. And Tillamook's a lot different because it's really owned by the county, and it's another big story, and there's whole groups about it. But people say how pristine and wonderful these forests are, and they are, but they both came from catastrophic fires. That's where they came from. When the land was cheap, we could get it, put it all together, and then grow a forest back. And it goes to this talk that I had before. We are the best place to grow forests in the world. But keeping them cleaned out and thinned and using them for multiple values is a really good thing to do. And we haven't done as well as we should with that, in my opinion.
Okay, great.
Mr. Chair.
Yes, Senator.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So a question to the conservation community. Where were you guys when all of a sudden the Elliott become dysfunctional then? Where was your groups then?
Go for it.
Chair Dembrough, Senator Bartsugar, Bob Van Dyke, Walt Samuelson. I've been attending land board meetings for longer than I'd like to say, and for a long time we haven't been part of any litigation that happened over time. We tried to work with Director Paul and his predecessors as well. We've long thought that it'd be desirable to get a habitat conservation plan, which to my mind is trying to do just the kind of thing you mentioned, that is find something that puts all the pieces together, keeps you within federal law, conserves enough habitat, provides other values to access logs, revenues for the fund. So I guess I'd just say, like any big group, there's some diversity within it. And so we've tried to be a constructive partner in the conversation. And to my mind, this bill is that sort of thing. It's something that says, okay, here's a tool that might help us get to a place where we can all agree more easily about how to manage the forest, because we've taken some tough pieces out of it and we've set those aside and we can focus on things where there's more agreement.
Well, obviously your voice wasn't very loud because I certainly didn't hear it.
And I was going to say,
I have to say that the staff at the State Lands has been awesome to work with over a lot of years for a lot of reasons. And they tried to get an HCP for a lot of years. I mean, I was one of those people that wanted them to do that from, what, I don't know if it was in the 90s or 2000s. They started working on it because we had one for a long time. It went away. We kept going back. NIMS would never get along. Every federal agency, every time we get close to one, would come up with something else. So we never got one. And I agree. I was all for trying to get an ACP until we couldn't get one. And then I said, you know, they're not willing to even have a conversation about doing this. It made it impossible. And that's why we're here today. So it wasn't just conservation groups. It was the federal government trying to figure out how they could give us an HCP. And if it wasn't coho, it then became, you know, the next bird in line. And that made it really hard.
Senator Dembro, Senator Roblin, you're right. It's not like they didn't try to get an HCP. You all may know that Washington State, there was a speaker there earlier, has very similar lands to ours, west side coastal rainforest. With the same species that are at risk that we have. But they did get an HCP, and an important part of them getting the HCP was they had this trust land transfer component. So they could take the parcels that weren't ecologically productive and move them out of the base from which they had to generate returns from. So the numbers worked out better by decoupling part of it over time. So it didn't happen quickly, as you know. I think they said 89 is when they started theirs, and they've appropriated I think almost $800 million over 20 years to slowly decouple parts. But what that's allowed to happen is to get an HCP, which then gives them confidence in being able to manage the land and some security that they won't be stopped because of endangered species concerns.
And one last,
yes, one. Senator.
And who has the only HCP right now working in Oregon? Weyerhaeuser.
The Milacoma Tree Farm.
Milacoma Tree Farm. So, I mean, it's kind of like, it just, yeah. Which now is not accessible as much, but that was a company decision.
It's not accessible at all.
Okay, thank you. thank you all very much for coming. Actually, Senator Roblin, I do have one question for you.
Sure.
I could bring Lori up, but it's just a question of how the Common School Fund dollars are being used now. Are they dedicated to certain things, or is it just, is this money that's coming into the school fund just like any money that comes into the school fund?
So the school fund, from it, a percentage of the money that comes that's there, mostly interest, is given back each year. I think last year it was $110 million or something like that. Oh, it got up to $300 million?
Okay, Lori,
4%.
Lori, why don't you
come on
up,
Lori. We could have the landlord, Jim, come up too. Come on,
yeah,
Jim.
Sure.
I mean, the reality is that all of our property that...
Sorry, Jim.
All the property that...
Trying
gets,
to keep you free.
All the property that gets left behind and nobody has it goes to them too. And it's all part of this big fund, which is over $1.5 billion, isn't it? Something like that.
Correct.
Okay, Jim.
Yeah. Good afternoon, Chair Debro, members of the committee. I'm Jim Paul, the director of the Department of State Lands. I believe the question is, how does the money, where does the money go, or how does the money go towards schools? Essentially, the current distribution policy that the land board uses, that the department implements, calls for a 4% of the three-year rolling average of the fund annually get distributed to schools. So we're about $1.5 billion today, but if we look back 3 years, it's a little bit less than that in terms of the average. So it's equated to about $110-$120 million we're at right now, and have been in the last year or two.
And it basically goes into the general fund of the school, or the
goes into the formula.
Yeah.
So if we were fully funding education, we wouldn't need this money. Is that true?
Chair Roblin, Lori Satinspiel for the Oregon School Boards Association. Fully funding, yes. I will say, since I am sitting up here, as written, sorry, Senator, we'd really like to see the legislature stay out of this and let the state land board deal with the decision. I like the trust lands concept. But you get 90 of you involved in this, and you talk about politics, and it's going to get even worse than I think we already have got going on. I think The Department of State Lands has been very transparent. They follow the process if we're going to talk about the LE, which this bill keeps turning into, but I understand it's not. And Jim could speak to the losses that the Elliott has caused, $1 million a year out of the Common School Fund. So fiduciary responsibility is our big deal at OSBA, that the State Land Board needs to hold up that end. And as this is happening, and it's been happening over years, it hasn't happened. The fiduciary responsibility is gone.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Przanski.
I've been sitting here listening to the conversations. So I guess I want to get, I thought I heard two of our colleagues, Senator Olson and Senator Roebling, say that this forest is actually belongs to the kids. And if that's the case, why don't we let them decide on what we do with that particular forest instead of us making those decisions? Because I bet you if you put it to the vote of those owners, we'd have a different outcome. And on the fiduciary duty, I mean, the reality, I heard testimony just 5-10 minutes ago that said we had losses for 3 years out of 10. Now, I haven't seen that in the data, but that's what was stated here. Mm-hmm. And is that how we're going to make our decisions? If we have a run of 2 or 3 years that are bad years, I mean, we have a recession that started in 2009 and went for how many years? Do we just sell the country?
Yeah. Chair Dembro, members of the committee, I want to be respectful of the topic of the bill not being about the Elliott, but I would definitely can speak to that comment, Senator Przanski. What led to where we are today in the Elliott, which is actually sort of the culmination of about 3 years of work by the department to seek to find a new solution, a more sustainable solution, after we came to the conclusion in 2014 that the current situation is not sustainable. We did a lot of analysis around looking back at our revenues and our trends and looking forward given where we are right now. And where we are right now was triggered by the result of the litigation we had to deal with filed in 2012 and resolved in 2014 that put the Elliott in a position of at best breaking even, at worst losing money. And our projections moving forward did not show a change in that. And eventually we will be under the status quo. We project we will be losing money every year to the tune of about $1 million, depending on the holding costs of the property. Over the previous 10 years leading up to 2013, we were seeing a general decline in revenues because the portion of the habitat conservation plan that we did have in place, which included Rumble Murelets, expired in 2001, and that made it increasingly difficult to continue maintaining the revenue we were generating to the point where we knew we were going to be constrained. That may put the fiduciary duty at risk. We worked, as you heard, we did work for about 10 years to try to renew that HCP and were unsuccessful. Currently, we do not project a change in the situation in terms of revenues. We've lost a cumulative of about $3 million over the past 4 fiscal years. This most recent fiscal year, we saw an uptick of about $1.3 million. Part of that was the effort to try and see, knowing that this protocol was in place and that the board had directed the department to be on path to sell, was to try to minimize the losses and generate as much revenues as we could under the current construct. But we currently only have, we believe, about 7 sales left on the Elliott for a number of years until stands come to age where we then have new opportunities would have new opportunities if we still held the property to start generating revenue again. But those are on generally the younger stands, the lower value stands, relatively speaking. And the holding cost for this property, we estimate, if you're not harvesting any timber and are simply trying to protect for fire, maintain your roads, manage the public, which the forest has been open to the public, is in the $750,000 to $1 million a year, just out-of-pocket costs just to hold the property. So that's the general situation around revenues and expenditures on the forest.
So just if I could follow up on that. So in terms of, you know, the current sales, so your ability to do more sales in this last year, how did that butt up against how you couldn't do that before? I mean, why? Yeah. Why can you do that now where you couldn't before?
Sure.
Presumably because of lawsuits.
Yes. Chair Dembro, we essentially in our work prior to August 2015, so August 2015 is when the land board approved of the protocol that essentially opted to put the forest on a path to transfer ownership under certain process and conditions and criteria. Prior to that date, we had, in our research around what are some options in front of us, we had asked the Department of Forestry to project forward what the outlook was for this forest given the current constraints that that are on the forest. And that outlook showed essentially a flat bouncing around zero in the short term. They only projected that out about 4 or 5 years, essentially because after that they did not project any additional timber sales being available under the current protections, and we would just see a negative. Once the protocol was adopted in 2015, we knew there was we anticipated a potential end in sight where the property would be transferred, and under that trajectory, the Department of Forestry would no longer be managing the forest after that period, and the Department of State Lands would no longer be owning it. And they did everything, and looking at the projections showing that we may be in the negative immediately, they worked diligently to not have that be the case, and essentially there was a case of compression where all the sales that they had modeled out, well, if we tried to stretch this out to sort of minimize the losses, some of those got moved up, as many as we could, given the timeline of the protocol, and we saw a result in a positive. It's important to keep in mind that because of the nature of this forest, a $1.3 million positive could be a single timber sale, or maybe two. And our year-to-year, we've seen one timber sale can make the difference between a loss and a gain. That's how difficult it is project when just a single sale can make the difference between a positive and a negative year.
Okay, and just before we get into that, and just I remember there being an issue related to the earnings of the fund, right, that was it during the recession, the fund took some hits as well, which exacerbated this problem. Is that a hole we were able to dig our way out of?
Chair Dembro, I would say that's sort of a separate issue just around sort of the notion of the fund itself and the viability of it and performance of it. We did, during the Great Recession, we did see the fund dropped almost, I think it dropped by 40%. We went from 1.2 or 3 billion down to in the 700 million range. It has recovered. We're now up to 1.5 billion. The metric that we, because of the intergenerational equity requirement, in the long-term interests of schools and the school children, the metric we use as a department is the since inception rate of return on the fund. The modern day fund was founded in 1995. We track the department that very closely, and that number bounces right around 7.25%. Every year it kind of shifts a little above and below that, but that's so we've seen that return hold, knowing that in a given year or two we can see a drop, another year or two we can see it come up. I think in 2009 or 2010 we actually saw 11 or 13% returns for one of those years. Currently we're, I think the last calendar year, I think we're at a negative or even a 1%. So these annual 3-year, 5-year can really vary, so we look at the longest term as we can, which seems to be hovering right around that 7.25%.
Sounds like PERS. Yes,
and part of the money that went into Elliott sales, we sold two little parts.
Three, we did.
Three, that's right. Mm-hmm. That's right. Okay, and how much did we get for that?
We generated, I believe it was a little over $4 million off of the sale of those three parcels.
And that money was also put in. So when you're thinking about the last 3 or 4 years, the losses, that's $4 million that we got. Went against other losses that had been in that same period.
It all eventually goes in the same pot.
Exactly, that's what
yeah,
I'm saying.
Those are monies that go into a particular fund that must be essentially the corpus of the fund versus operational costs at the other ones.
But is that included in, you know, if you look at the annual minuses or pluses? Is that somewhere else, or is that part of
that? Minuses or pluses was at the net operating revenues, is specifically about the net operating revenues.
So
if we start looking outside of that, there's that. There's also, we've spent about $3.5 million on the protocol process. So once you start adding categories, it's sort of where do you stop?
Exactly.
So, yeah, we try to, we report every year in our annual report, annual net revenue and operating revenue. So that's why we look to those numbers.
Right.
Yeah, in terms of consistency. Yeah.
Senator Bertrager.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So the scenario that you painted for the future is pretty dim. However, if there was some federal policy changes, that would be a totally different scenario, correct?
Correct. Potentially correct, yes.
Thank you.
I will, if I could, just say to that, too, another principle that we are obligated to follow, which is really just through the history of case law of these types of lands across 23 different western states, is the obligation to follow what's called a prudent investment standard, prudent investor standard, with the Common School Fund and with Common School Trust lands. And that means that the decisions we make with these lands and with Common School Fund assets should be similar to what a prudent investor would make, which would mean not which would mean using professional advice and looking forward around what's likely, what's possible, what's feasible, as opposed to too much speculation, too much out into the future, so to speak, or too much uncertainty around what might or might happen. Because once you get into that realm, you risk possibly favoring future generations over the current. If you speculate to a degree where you're sacrificing something today and aren't really sure about the benefit of the future, or vice versa. You speculate too far the other way, and you may actually end up benefiting the current generation inadvertently over the future because of the type of speculation. So, but that prudent investment standard is one that we look at as well in terms of ensuring that fiduciary duty is that we're meeting or defensible in terms of what we do with that standard.
Follow up?
Yes.
Does the state of Oregon have a lobbyist in D.C.?
Senator Bertrager, I suspect that you want some change in federal forest practices.
This is for Lori. I appreciate your concern about getting the legislature in the midst of everything else. The reality is this bill doesn't purport to do that. It basically says we would like the legislature to be able to fund future sales so that we can do things like Washington's doing, so they would be involved, but only if Department of State Lands brought forward things for us to do, which is what they do during the budget process anyway. So it isn't that we get us more involved, other than that it gives them one more tool to come and ask us for resources to keep and manage their land. And purposely, just because they had done a really amazing process, in my opinion, you'll see the bill written the way it was. That doesn't mean that other people haven't felt that it could be used in other ways. And it had emergency clauses and that kind of stuff. It could be. But that was not the intention when I did it this time. That was the intention when I did it the first time. So just say, I'd like to be clear with people that.
Chair and Senator Roblin, thank you.
Okay. And, you know, if I could just add to that, I think that too often in the conversations around the Elliott, there's been a notion that if we did a transfer, there'd be no more cutting in the Elliott. And I don't think that's anything anyone wants.
No.
Presumably, we could have an HCP in this new, with this new ownership that could bring revenue to the state to do some of that debt service that would be required, no?
Chair Denborough, what I can tell you is the last place that we left the HCP conversation before the protocol was adopted in August 2015, we made our best estimate at our third run at it, so to speak, with the services. We had to have a lot of assumptions built into that, but our best case scenario was that the revenues, the harvest levels would be somewhere between 23 and 27 million, equating to revenues between $2 to $6 million per year. The caveats around that, or the risk around those caveats, also factored into that because it required some assumptions around how the negotiations would eventually result in with the federal services. So presumably, if those numbers are accurate and still hold, given that was just 2 years ago, there may be some revenue under the HCP. I think fundamentally where we ended up at that time was that we did, given all things considered, given that level of revenue plus all things considered, we weren't confident we could say that the fiduciary duty would be met in a defensible way at the end of the day. We might have been able to get there, but we didn't have enough information to say we're confident we can get there, and that factored into the board's decision in August to adopt the protocol.
And just looking at the, if the state were ultimately to accept the offer that's out there, which is about $220 million, what kind of assumption is there about the earnings that the fund would receive? $15.5 million.
You got the 7%.
Yes. So, Chair Denbrough,
the 7% is. So yeah, that's the current investment portfolio of this of the fund.
The direction from the board is that if that transaction goes through, those monies would be deposited permanently into the fund and then be managed under the fund as the $1.5 billion are, which has been earning 7.25% since 1995.
Bill, a little bit bigger than $15 million a year.
Question.
Yes.
So does that money go into state banking fund? Is that where it goes for its investment?
So those funds are managed for the department by the investment division and kept in a separate common school fund account. Yep.
But it's lumped in with all the monies in the state banking system.
Or the state investment pool?
It is. They pool. I'd have to have investment division help. They do, to the extent they can, they pool these. The investment pools are shared between different funds. The allocation is specific to the common school fund, but some pieces of that allocation are the same allocation that other funds have. So there's some overlapping pooling. And beyond that, I'm getting into an area I'm going to get myself in trouble with. Yeah.
Yeah, I think that what happens is that they tell the investment world what risk they want to take, mm-hmm. and they invest it in that risk category. Others get invested in other risk categories based on the.
We've had all this great experience with PERS, so I'm a little nervous about some of this investment stuff.
Though even in PERS, even though we lost a fair amount, we lost less than a lot of other states did.
Oh, I know, but we're still.
Our people have done a good job in investing.
Yeah. Okay, thank you both very much. Okay, colleagues, if there are no other questions or comments on this subject, Senator Roblin, again, thank you for bringing this forward. We'll talk about whether it's ready to go or not.
Yep, no problem. Okay. And any suggestions anybody has?
Okay, so with that, before I call us to an end, just a reminder, we are meeting tomorrow night in our work group where we're going to be meeting with the we're hearing about a report from the Associated Oregon Industries in response to carbon pricing, what the impact would be on the Oregon economy. And we're also going to be meeting by phone or Skype with the energy minister from the province of Ontario. So it should be a very interesting meeting tomorrow. So, colleagues, with that, we are adjourned.
Thank you.
With that, we are adjourned.
Thank you.